Hello and welcome to Alita Dagma Shades of Murder, a podcast where I will share and discuss tales of true crime, mysteries, and all things dark and macabre. If you eat plain dream and shades of murder like me, then welcome, my kindred spirits, to your new podcast home. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and subscribe, share, and consider a 5-star rating so I can present more stories to you and we can all embrace the love of the darkness together. All of my contact information you can find in the episode description below. Please be forewarned that each episode contains specific and at times very graphic and disturbing details of the case and may not be intended for all audiences. This case is not to be listened to lightly. It is very graphic and contains some extremely disturbing details of the crime, but it is an important and compelling story to hear. This murder has been showcased on other podcasts and YouTube shows, but the focus has always been placed on the grotesqueness of the crime and has neglected to explore the pertinent and much more compelling elements of what triggered the event and how it all unfolded. This is the story of Omima Nelson. On a night when turkeys are carved and bowls of gravy are passed around the family table, a nightmarish murder scene would unfold in the kitchen of Omima Nelson's home. That evening, in their lovely apartment in Costa Mesa, California, Omima's much older husband, 56-year-old William Nelson, would attempt to force himself upon her. And not for the first time, even that same day. The sexual assaults had only become worse, and Omima no longer would allow herself to be his victim. In a moment of rage, Omima plunged a pair of scissors into his chest and stomach. She then struck her husband over the head with an iron and proceeded to bash his head with it over and over again. She went into shock, fell into a state of what can only be described as mental displacement, and began to cut up his body on the kitchen floor. Over the next 12 hours, this battered and deranged woman would hack up her large husband into pieces and do her best to shove much of his flesh and internal parts down the garbage disposal. Omima Nelson may have gotten away with the crime, except for the fact that her husband had been a very large man, which made him even more difficult and time-consuming to dispose of. As a result, she made the unfortunate error of trusting the wrong person. I'm not sure about all of you listeners out there, but for many of us in the true crime world, we half jokingly discuss how everyone needs that one person you can turn to if and when you must dispose of the body. There is only one person you can entrust this to. For me, I have that one person, and they know who they are. So thank you. Unfortunately, for Omima Nelson, she did not have any trustworthy friends who had her back. When she turned to someone for help in the disposal of William Nelson's body, that person she reached out to said that he would help her, but instead they betrayed her and turned her over to law enforcement. Apparently, Omima had also enlisted the aid of two ex-boyfriends to remove the teeth from William Nelson's decapitated skull to further destroy evidence of his identity. When this phone call led homicide investigators to Omima Nelson's door, they found on the front seat of her dead husband's red Corvette, which she had been driving around town in, several black trash bags filled with various body parts. The detectives at the scene were shocked and horrified by the discovery of human organs in the vehicle. Upon entry to their apartment, they were stunned and not prepared for the nightmarish scene inside. William Nelson's hands were found inside the deep fryer. His head was propped up in the freezer. Several random dismembered body parts were located stuffed inside a brown suitcase. Omima Nelson was promptly detained and interrogated. The next morning, on December 3rd, 1991, she was arrested and held on a $250,000 bail while investigators tried to piece together the crime. A little over a year later, Omima Nelson, who was only 23 years old at the time of the offense, would at last take the stand. I can only imagine how taken back the jurors were at the beautiful young woman who was a model and former nanny who had committed this horrific crime. Once she was given the chance to tell her story, Omima Nelson confessed to stabbing and bludgeoning her new husband in a desperate attempt to prevent him from raping her. She was not going to allow herself to be sexually assaulted by him again, and she picked up a pair of scissors and stabbed her husband with them over and over again. The rage that had deeply nested itself inside Omima her entire life had been freed, and she grabbed an iron and other random objects within their home and beat him senseless with them until he lay dead and bloodied on the floor. In her own words, she freaked out when she realized what she had done and became psychologically detached from the events that would follow as she slipped into a trance-like state. The jury, which consisted of 8 women and 4 men, listened in horror and disbelief as the events of that night were revealed. After Omima Nelson realized her husband William was dead, the ritual of dismemberment began. She chopped off his hands and then boiled them in a pot on the stove in oil with the purpose of removing any fingerprints. The victim's torso had been skinned, also referred to as flayed. Omima openly admitted to how she had cooked her husband's head and placed it inside their freezer so she could more easily pull out his teeth. Using leftovers from their Thanksgiving meal the day before, she blended in parts of his body with the turkey and stuffing, went to the apartment complex's trash bin, and hid them there inside a bag. Omima Nelson also confessed to having castrated her husband William Nelson in vengeance for his vicious sexual attacks. One of her neighbors testified to hearing the repetitive sounds of chopping and the grinding of their garbage disposal all throughout the night. The investigators of the crime scene found various remains of William Nelson's corpse stuffed into garbage bags in the apartment's trash bin, as Omima had confessed to, but reported that some parts of him were never recovered. Understandably, the jurors and the foreman were quite disturbed and traumatized by the graphic images of the man's body, or shall I say, the pieces of the man's body they were forced to look at as evidence. Her psychiatrist, Dr. David J. Scheffner, diagnosed Omima Nelson as a psychotic, and that in his 20 years of practice, he had never encountered such a bizarre and psychotic offender. In addition to her confession on the stand and the evidence presented by the prosecution, it was learned by the psychiatrist in his sessions with her that she had dressed up for the all-night event. Allegedly, according to the defendant, she put on red high heels, wore a red hat, and painted her lips in red for the ritual of the dismemberment and disposal of her husband's body. Although she tried to claim it was not true during the trial, Omima had confessed to her doctor how she had prepared his ribs, like they do in restaurants, explaining how she brushed his ribs with barbecue sauce and cooked them inside the oven. Her psychiatrist recounted to the court how in one session she expressed to him how she sat down at their kitchen table and chewed into his ribs, saying out loud to herself, and I quote, "It's so sweet, it's so delicious. I like mine tender." Deputy District Attorney Randolph J. Pulaski treated Omima Nelson as a hostile defendant. He painted her to the jury as a predator, a young, beautiful immigrant woman who used men for money and luxuries, and in the case of William Nelson, his purpose had expired. Attorney Pulaski illustrated how Omima murdered Nelson in her greed and darkness, and that she had all intention of stealing his money and car and running away. During the trial, he asked Omima facetiously if she would assist in gathering the rest of the evidence since there were still a lot of missing meat from the large man. He addressed her saying, and I quote, "We're missing about 130 pounds of bill. You know where he might have gone?" During her trial, Omaima Nelson shared with the court how she had been a victim of severe physical and sexual abuse in her native country of Egypt as a young girl. Like millions of other young girls, even as young as infants, Omaima was forced to undergo what is known as female circumcision, which is nothing like what male circumcision entails. Omaima fled Egypt for the United States in 1986 for a new life and for a world away from the discrimination and abuse she and so many women endured there. However, the genital mutilation she was subjected to and the abuse she was forced to experience growing up in Egypt prevented her from being able to enjoy sexual intercourse. She was so severely damaged internally and externally that she could not experience pleasure. Her experiences with men in the United States only led to further damage of her self-image and sense of personal worth, as she became intertwined with one abusive, violent man after the other. Upon meeting the much older and seemingly kind and gentle William E. Bill Nelson, she experienced for the first time what she believed to be love. Here was a man who was stable, financially well off, adored her, and treated her better than any other man had before. She believed she had found her knight in shining armor, and based on this belief, Omaima accepted his proposal only a few days after meeting one another. She even complied with having sex with Nelson several times a day because she loved him and wanted him to be happy. But according to Omaima, the gentleman and William Nelson did not last long. William Nelson, who was a pilot, had a criminal record for dealing marijuana, but there were no signs or indicators that he was a violent man. William Nelson, who was originally from the Midwest, returned to his old home to spend their honeymoon there and to introduce his young, beautiful bride to his adult children. According to Omaima, it was there that she first was exposed to his dark and violent side. She claimed that he demanded sex within the realm of S&M, in particular acts involving bondage. When she resisted and tried to refuse him, he would lose his temper and become erratic, violent, and cruel. He would find torturous ways to punish her when she defied him, such as when one time she claimed that he threw her new kitten outside of his vehicle's window. Her husband then began to sell her body to older men in exchange for money and even once for a car. Omaima said that her husband saw her as his property and that he told her, and I quote, "I paid for you. I'm getting what I paid for." She claimed that he threatened to abandon her in the desert and that if she did not do as he pleased, he would report her to the authorities and say she was a Mexican prostitute. She said that she stayed with him because he would sincerely apologize after the abuse, and she was scared of what he would do to her if she actually left. He raped and beat her multiple times on one particular occasion when she told him she was done with his abuse and was leaving him. It was on such an occasion during Thanksgiving in 1991 when her husband forced himself upon her that Omaima Nelson had had enough. The prosecution did their best to present Omaima Nelson as a monster and even made a fictional comparison of her to that of Hannibal Lecter. I find the prosecution even being allowed to compare her to a fictional character in a film laughable, offensive, and really should not be permitted in a court of law. I mean, talk about sensationalizing the court trial and not sticking to the evidence. Omaima Nelson, by all accounts, was mentally ill, psychologically broken, and very likely deserved the diagnosis of a psychotic. But was she psychotic in the sense of a Hannibal Lecter-like character? No. She was uneducated, a female immigrant who had suffered unimaginable amounts of sexual and physical abuse, was emotionally damaged, and did what she had to in order to survive in a new world. They said she was a liar, that she was not a survivor or victim of abuse, and that William Nelson was the true victim, pointing out the evidence that his ankles had been bound during the attack. Although this is an interesting element of the evidence, first of all, we already know they were engaged in S&M practice. Secondly, I wonder how they determined this to be true. Had his ankles been discovered in the garbage bags to which the autopsy showed there to be signs of binding, like ligature marks found on wrists or around the neck? Amaima Nelson also had a previous and quite extensive criminal record, which was reflective of her unhinged mental state, but nevertheless did not help her already aggravated murder case. She was first convicted on 2 counts of auto theft and shoplifting on December 10, 1987. Less than 2 years later, she was charged with a hit and run for property damage, more shoplifting, and assault and battery of a security officer whom she bit. Then in early 1990, she was arrested for a DUI, then driving without a license that June, and in November of that year, assault with a firearm. Amaima Nelson's lawyer, public defender Thomas G. Mooney, painted his client as the victim, and that she was not a monster, but rather a frightened and abused young woman. She killed him while fighting off her rapist in self-defense and did everything she felt had been necessary to cover up the crime. The defense attorney and the testimony offered by Amaima herself did not sway the jury into believing she was innocent of the crime based on self-defense, especially considering the horrifying and grotesque details of the homicide and concealment of his death. Over 6 days, the Orange County Superior Court jury deliberated. The defendant must have induced enough sympathy and lack of sound mind, though, because they could not agree on her committing premeditated first-degree murder. Amaima Nelson was acquitted of the first-degree murder charge. Instead, the jury returned with a conviction of second-degree murder, which held a maximum sentence of 25 years imprisonment. In addition to being convicted of second-degree murder, Amaima Nelson was also found guilty of assaulting another wealthy, much older white man, Robert Hansen of Huntington Beach, California, in November of that previous year. He claimed that she had bound him and threatened him with a gun if he did not give her his money. The jurors did not believe his story entirely, though, and Amaima was acquitted of the more serious charges of false imprisonment and attempted robbery. However, in both the murder of her husband and the assault on Hansen, her boyfriend at the time of the attack, Amaima had yielded weapons, a knife on her husband and a gun on her boyfriend, which led to aggravating circumstances in each crime. Under California criminal law, this could increase her sentence by an additional 6 years. Amaima Nelson now was faced with 18 years to life in prison for the killing of William Nelson, with a knife being utilized in his death, and an additional 10 years incarceration for the assault on Hansen with a gun. The judge sentenced her to 25 years to life, which is the maximum she could receive, and under California law, she has to complete 80% of the sentence. In 2002, Amaima Nelson filed for habeas corpus under the claim of ineffective counsel for their failure to not have her plead not guilty by reason of insanity. I would have thought she had something to stand on with this claim because I absolutely agree that this plea should have been used, or a plea of guilty by reason of insanity. Unfortunately for Amaima, this petition was denied by the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California in 2003, which said it was beyond the statute of limitations. The first time she was made eligible for parole was in 2006. Her attorney, Terrence Scott, fought for her in an appeals court that same year, arguing that the reason why Amaima Nelson had chopped up her husband's body was because Egyptian mythology believed that if one chops up the body of their enemy, then they will not face them in the afterlife. Now, during my research, I cannot locate anything regarding this particular belief. From what I did read, this belief may have derived from the story of Osiris, whose own brother Set plotted against him in jealousy, murdered him, and then dismembered him into 14 pieces, spreading him throughout Egypt. Perhaps this was his way of dishonoring him, and by cutting him up into as many pieces and placing them in different places, he was stripping him of his power and thus thwarting his entry into the afterlife. Then, in relation to this mythology, by dismembering her husband, Omaima was not just trying to conceal the crime, but rid him of his dignity, power, and self-respect, and thus any remaining hold over her in the afterlife. This is just my interpretation of how this mythology could have possibly affected her beliefs and actions. She was denied an appeal and her possibility to be freed from prison, based on at least what the prosecutor Pulaski stated was her own lack of remorse, how she has not taken responsibility for what she has done, and that she still places the blame for her crimes upon the victim. I'm not sure how this holds any ground when she fully confessed to everything she did to the victim, including how she killed him, the details as to how she attempted to get rid of his body, and that she was sorry that she took his life, but she believed it was the only way to save her own. The district attorney addressed how Omaima Nelson, up to that point in her incarceration, had neglected to finish any education or vocation-based courses provided there, and that she did not follow the rules and regulations of the prison. It did not help Omaima Nelson's attempt at parole that she was the opposite of a model prisoner while incarcerated. Between 1993 and 2005, she was cited with 7 major rule violations. These included a fight in the day room, battery of a prison staff member, concealment of contraband, theft of headphones, 2 more for mutual combat, and failure to comply with directions. In addition to these major violations, Omaima had an additional 8 minor ones. Between 1995 and 2004, she was cited with disturbance in a class for getting into a verbal disagreement, holding in her possession unissued property, being out of bounds, failure to report to class, failure to report to her assigned position, use of the phone during an unassigned time, lying on her bunk when prison staff were conducting a headcount, and being non-compliant with grooming standards. Wow, I mean, it sounds like she's in grade school instead of an adult prison with these menial, trivial, and ridiculous numbers and types of citations. I understand the citations for the major issues, especially if they involve violence. But seriously, failure to report to class? I know, here's a great idea. Why don't we treat the incarcerated like children? Berate them? Penalize them for the most minor infractions and not provide them with any real guidance or treatment? This approach, I am sure, is especially effective for those who have a mental illness, a history of abuse and violence, and who are all around psychologically impaired. Good job, American penal system. Insert sarcasm here. In 2019, Omaima Nelson applied to the Ninth Circuit Court for authorization to file a second habeas corpus petition under the decision McCoy made by the Supreme Court in 2018. Under this ruling, the court held that if the defense counsel concedes guilt for their client during trial, after the defendant has directed them to maintain their innocence, this is in direct violation of their Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial. However, the courts have their ways around prisoners filing claims, which are often not clarified to them and are used to successfully defeat their attempts. Since Congress had placed a 1-year statute of limitations on habeas corpus petitions being filed, the petitioner must file an application to receive authorization to file a secondary petition for a writ within 1 calendar year date in which the constitutional right was first acknowledged by the Supreme Court. The decision made in McCoy was on May 14, 2018, but Omaima did not file her application until November 26, 2019. which successfully destroyed any consideration of her being able to file a second habeas corpus. Omaima Nelson will not be eligible for parole again until 2026. There is a current movement to free Omaima Nelson set up through change.org, which I personally have signed many different petitions on. However, I only sign something once I have done my own research on the matter. It may be obvious to say, but I think it is very important that we all do our own due diligence before placing support behind a convicted criminal who could still pose a potentially serious threat to others in society. Really, any social or political petition should be looked at very closely and not take the word of another person or website. In the case of Omaima Nelson, according to reports, she has not only been a model prisoner while incarcerated, no pun intended, but has done everything to rehabilitate and better herself during her time there. She currently resides at the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, California. It would be almost too easy to label this horrifying story as one that is merely committed by a psychotic and to only focus on the disgusting details, which I think skips over the most important and the most interesting elements of this case. This young woman was a victim of violence and sexual abuse her entire life. From a tender age, she was sexually mutilated to be assimilated into an archaic and brutal belief system regarding the purpose and value of women in her culture. She was marked for life, damned to never experience real physical pleasure, and was taught very early on, because it was, that it was men who caused this suffering. Female genital mutilation is a widespread practice across most nations in Africa, many in the Middle East, and some in Asia. Some may claim it to be a tradition and not something that our Western cultures should interfere in, but nothing could be further from the truth. For centuries, this external cutting, whether partial or total removal of a female's genitalia, the sealing and stitching up a part of their vagina, or a combination, has been done with the mistaken belief that is necessary for reasons of chaste, religion, and hygiene. It has also been utilized as a tool to eliminate a woman's sexual pleasure. From as old as 15 to as young as infants, girls are subjected to this brutal and cruel tradition. More than 200 million girls and women have been forced to endure this mutilation. And oftentimes it causes severe health complications. Please understand that these procedures are carried out often by a non-medical professional, and they are not for any reason based on legitimate healthcare. In fact, the cost of the fallout of female genital mutilation is over $1 billion. Not only does female genital mutilation induce zero benefits to the recipient, but it causes severe bleeding, trouble with urination, cysts, and infections, increases the difficulty of carrying a baby later on, and increases the chances that a child will be stillborn. They also have caused hemorrhages and death. Research indicates that the long-term psychological effects female genital mutilation has on its victims can be very serious and often debilitating. One study reported that a sixth of circumcised immigrant women exhibit thresholds that surpass those of PTSD, and a third of them suffer from severe degrees of depression and anxiety. The trauma and brutality these women were forced to endure, especially at such a young and vulnerable age, increases their chances for substance abuse and a wide range of mental health issues. It seems completely insane why and how this continues to go on. But since it is perceived as a social norm and totally accepted by the cultures who practice it, it has not been easily eradicated. This is a human rights violation, an exercise of female discrimination at its most extreme. And there are many organizations, with WHO at its forefront, who are committed to spreading education about this practice, helping those who are subjected to it, and those who help to perpetuate it understand the extreme damage they are inflicting upon females. Unfortunately, at the time of Omaima's female genital mutilation, there was not a global movement against this practice. She was a victim at a young age of this brutal act, which inflicted unmeasurable amounts of harm upon her body, her psyche, and her spirit. Understandably, I think she hated men and wanted to get as much as she could out of them, since thanks to the patriarchal forces in her own country, her capability for real pleasure had been severely minimized, if not completely absent from her life. Just imagine that. This happens to countless girls and women in these nations, which most of the world turns a blind eye to. This is not about cultural differences. This is about minimizing the female purpose and value in these cultures. They are not allowed to be educated, not allowed to express themselves, not allowed to pursue their dreams, and are not permitted to have pleasure. Their existence is solely to serve that of the men in society. And most of the women who have been subjected to this abuse and discrimination for so long that it is difficult, if not impossible, for them to even understand how wrong, how dangerous, and permanently damaging this is. I don't blame Omaima Nelson one bit for hating men. Having such deep resentment and rage toward them for the abuse and exploitation she continued to suffer from when she came to a country that she believed would be her salvation, her escape from her past. It is of little surprise, after she was pushed to the edge too many times, that she snapped. The other equally important and intriguing element of this case is her confession that she ate part of her dead husband, which she attempted to withdraw later on. It is easy to be revolted, even nauseated, by the act of cannibalism. And trust me, the thought of eating a human being is both of those things. But it is important to have some insight into the history of this taboo subject to understand the offender and her actions. The act of cannibalism has been presented one-sidedly in most discussions and in media presentations, true crime and fiction, because it is unthinkable, disgusting, and hard to conceive of doing, even under the most severe of circumstances, that being starvation. Although it is very rare for societies to practice it in modern times, there are some cultures that still do. The act of cannibalism has not been a popular school of research and historically was often suppressed by those of the Western world, in particular by missionaries and agents of colonialism. There have been records of various cultures consuming members for sheer survival in times of great famine. Research has revealed that such practices have been recorded in a wide diversity of countries and cultures in times of extreme and sustained stress, in particular during times of famine, and has been practiced worldwide. From Japan, China, what was once known to Persia, to France, cannibalism has been something societies have partaken in under the most extreme of circumstances. Cannibalism, also known as anthropophagy, which is the Latin term for man-eating, is reported to have been practiced way before the time of Homo sapiens, inside the caves of Homo antecessor, who was the common ancestor of modern humans and Neanderthals. Defleshed human bones have been discovered, dating back as far as 600,000 years. In Goh's Cave in England, remains of humans provided evidence of the practice of cannibalism in unique ways, such as how many of the skulls were utilized as drinking vessels. As to whether the Egyptians practiced cannibalism is hotly debated, since the pyramid texts found which pointed to its practice have been deemed by some to be merely metaphorical in nature, and not to be taken literal. Diodorus Siculus, a Greek writer in the 1st century BC, wrote down an ancient story involving the god Osiris, forbidding the Egyptians from consuming the flesh of humans. First, it is critical for this discussion to realize that there are two different kinds of cannibalism which exist. It is not as simple as individuals who consume others for survival while lost at sea or in some other hostile environment, or the element of the twisted case of a serial killer. Although while doing this research, it made me see things a little more complicated and their purpose of doing so when involving the latter. There is endocannibalism, and then there is exocannibalism. The same actions, with entirely opposite targets, motivations, and intent. Exocannibalism involves consuming the flesh of others where the individual or members of a group are often perceived as the enemy, such as prisoners of war or those killed in combat. The primary motivation for exocannibalism is to take vengeance upon the enemy and or to absorb their virtuous powers, such as bravery, wisdom, or strength. For some cultures, such as those in Fiji, one does not eat an enemy who is not courageous and strong, since by consuming them, they will assimilate these virtues. It has also been enacted by some societies to exhibit aggressive and antisocial behavior. This can be seen in situations where individuals consume someone who has caused harm to their loved ones. Those who were believed to be malevolent and had caused harm to the community could also face cannibalism as a concept of punishment. In South Papua, during the early 1960s through the early 1970s, the vast majority of deaths were believed to have been the result of witchcraft and sorcery, many of whom were murdered by their communities and their flesh eaten. This act of cannibalism is enacted in such a manner as to express disdain, disrespect, and hostility toward the enemy. Contrary to this practice believed to have stopped centuries ago, various documentation, such as the case in Papua New Guinea, has proven otherwise. It was documented by Médecins Sans Frontières, which is an international medical charity, how soldiers in Liberia in the 1980s participating in what were known to be ritualized feasts. This ritual cannibalism is rooted in the purpose of drawing in physical and spiritual powers through the consumption of human flesh. It is also serves the purpose of terrifying the enemy. For the children who served in Joseph Kony's infamous army in Uganda, the practice of exocannibalism was used as a ritual to initiate a boy becoming a man. Where exocannibalism is practiced against the enemy, endocannibalism is utilized to show love, respect, and honor to the dead. It is believed by some cultures that eating parts of the dead relative helps them to move on to the other world, which may be a way of holding on to them by absorbing their positive attributes. Various parts in the lowlands of South America have been recorded as being involved in the act of endocannibalism than any other part of the world, specifically as an element of the funerary or mortuary rite. Most often, the flesh of their deceased loved one is cooked and consumed, or they would roast and grind up the bones and consume the ash. The eating of the bones was popular in northern Brazil, in the western and northern parts of Amazonia, and within the upper Orinoco regions of southern Venezuela. One particular event was recorded among the Amahuaca in Peru, where a grieving mother wailed as she ground her daughter's bones into a powder and blended them into a drink made of maize. The ritual unfolded almost over 2 weeks, which ended in the mother tossing the remaining ashes of her child into the river. Although the act of cannibalism is difficult to get past, in this sense it does resonate with how the consumption of their deceased loved one is a way to stay with them. Yes, it is still disgusting and bizarre, but in this context, I can grasp the meaning of what is behind this ritual for those who believe in its power and purpose. And in its own way, it's poignant, deep, and kind of beautiful. The act of cannibalism has also been viewed by some monks and ascetics as a way to transcend one's own spirit, mind, and body. The Aghoris are a sect of Hindu ascetics who reside in India, whose beliefs center around the concept that all things in the universe are equally sacred, including that of human remains. Through the actions of holding and caressing the bodies of the deceased and consuming human flesh, their goal is to move beyond the parameters and categories that humans have strictly labeled as being natural and reach a state of nirvana in the process. During the 1500s, the Tibetan monks consumed what were referred to as pills of flesh. These pills of flesh were the remains of Brahmin ascetics. Now, ascetics are people who practice an extreme form of self-discipline and abstention, in particular from any source of pleasure, with the goal of reaching a higher spiritual plane. Brahmins were the most powerful members of the spiritual communities in Hindu society. They represented the most enlightened and wisest of them all. The consumption of spiritual and intellectual elites was perceived as the ultimate source of transcendence. There was strong documentation of this practice, whose primary purpose was to create a bridge between the recipient of the flesh pill and the spiritual leader whom they consumed. Viewed through these unique and deeply meaningful cultural experiences, one can begin to see how cannibalism is perceived as food for the spirit, mind, and body. Interest in practices and cannibalism in the Western world had its origins in an unusual place. Known for its healing powers, momia is a highly praised substance that is exclusively located on a single mountainside in Persia. Its name is derived from the local word for wax. This mum was utilized in a wide range of medicinal purposes, and in the Arabic world was known for being an invaluable and very costly substance. The problem happened, as it often does, when Western Europeans, upon their initial exposure to the Islamic world, mistranslated the text for momia. Translators during the 11th and 12th centuries incorrectly identified momia as a substance that was derived from the mummified bodies within Egyptian tombs. Due to this poor translation and thus complete misinterpretation of the text, medical cannibalism in Europe was practiced by the elite, especially for many generations in medieval Europe. This led to the creation of many different beliefs surrounding the substance and how it could help heal. From the blood of gladiators healing epilepsy to human fat mixed into homeopathic medicines, it was used to help headaches, to prevent heart attacks, anything imaginable. During this time, it was popularly documented how individuals were raiding Egyptian tombs and stealing their contents, from pottery to the jewels hidden inside. However, there were also those who were stealing the mummies themselves and stealing them for high profits. The demand grossly outweighed the resources available, which led to body snatchers and immoral tradesmen stealing fresh corpses of the executed, the enslaved, and others, and transforming them into mummies. One record of this described how a body snatcher would take the body of a person who had been hanged, embalm the body with salt and drugs, dry it inside an oven, and grind the remains or ash into a powder, which apothecaries would purchase to create home remedies. During the Victorian era, the craze for all things Egyptian was so huge that unwrapping mummies was an actual event inside some lecture halls, at hospitals, or even unveiled at exclusive gatherings inside private homes. Can you even imagine being invited to such an event? I mean, it would have been surreal, amazing, full of wonder and mystique, and creepy and terrifying all at once, not to mention the whole unwrapping of a mummy thing, which is beyond dishonorable and I would think would not be the best energy to leave around. What do you think about Omai Mendelsohn and the motivations behind this horrific crime? Not on any level am I condoning her actions, because she committed an absolutely vile act of murder. However, I think, no pun intended, that dissecting the pieces of her life and viewing her behavior on a deeper and multi-layered level, as I hope I have succeeded in doing with this episode, helps to see her and her crimes on a different, more compelling level. She was not just a murderer. She was not just a cannibal. She was a terrified, brutally traumatized woman who snapped in the truest and most simple sense of the word. Do I believe she has redeemed and progressed enough to be free? I personally do not believe that it would be wise to let her back into society, but I don't necessarily think she should be locked up in prison the rest of her days either, nor should she ever have been. Omaima Nelson is a prime example of an individual who should have pled guilty by reason of insanity and spent the rest of her life at a mental health facility. Who knows? Maybe if her defense attorney and our criminal justice system had done their job better, then she would have received the mental health treatment she desperately needed and deserved even before these events, and this murder would never have happened. What are your thoughts on Omaima Nelson? Do you think she was just a mad woman who killed and ate her husband? Or was she severely abused, a traumatized young woman who murdered, dismembered, and consumed parts of her victim so he no longer had power over her? Thank you so much for listening to this case. I appreciate each and every one of you, and I am beyond thrilled to be your host. Until next time, stay safe. And watch out for shades of murder happening in the streets, next door, and especially inside your own home. Alina Dama's Shades of Murder is created, researched, written, and edited by Alina Dama. Music courtesy of Pixabay by Ashot the Nilian.